Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I have the pleasure to talk with Dr. Trevor Schaufnagel. Dr. Schaufnagel earned his PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Washington. He is an expert in the delivery of CBT and DBT. He maintains a private practice, Balanced CBT, in Beverly Hills, California, and his primary focus is on treating anxiety and related disorders. He also holds an appointment in the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at UCLA, where he is an associate director of the UCLA Anxiety Disorder Clinic and the UCLA Department of Psychology, where he supervises graduate students in the doctoral program. Welcome, Trevor. All right. Well, welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today I have on as our guest, Dr. Trevor Schaufnagel. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to have you on because I've worked with you, you know, for a few years, and I know that you have a specialty in treatment of anxiety amongst other disorders and the use of cognitive behavioral therapy. So I'm glad to be able to talk about that today with you.
Yeah, awesome. I appreciate the opportunity as well.
So maybe just simply start out in terms of thinking about anxiety and how you think about initially treating anxiety with cognitive behavioral therapy or kind of other modalities that you bring in.
Mm-hmm. Sounds perfect. So let's see, for me, I think about anxiety always through the lens of cognition and behavior. And I think you hear enough of the time these days, especially, that anxiety is very functional and that it's very healthy. And the goal is never to eliminate anxiety. So we sort of want to definitely start from the perspective that the bulk of our anxiousness or nervousness or worry provides functional benefit to us, and that we've evolved to have it and it has protected us. It's most certainly not a dangerous response, otherwise we would have evolved not to have it. So that's the place we kind of want to start. And then we're thinking about anxiety as a sort of mental health condition or challenge or as a disorder. And we're thinking about, okay, people with anxiety disorders or pursuing treatment for anxiety typically are falling prey to almost a syndrome of false alarms, where a mechanism that's typically very, very helpful for us has sort of gotten hijacked. And now, instead of being our friend, it's a bit of a combatant. And CBT, just generally speaking, is sort of steeped in the scientific method and kind of stems from the presumption that there are patterns of thinking, which is cognition, and patterns of behaving that are intended to be helpful for us, but are for some reason sort of accidentally perpetuating the very problem that they're intended to relieve. And so generally, when I first meet someone or I first start conceptualizing a person's anxiety, I'm thinking, what's the cue or what is the perceived threat? And how are they managing that in their mind or with their behavior in a way that is inadvertently making things worse or digging the hole deeper? I guess that's where I start.
Got it. Hey, when you were talking, it kind of just made me think about, you know, anxiety, there's an adaptive quality to it. And what's the difference between someone whose anxiety field of reference has kind of gone haywire versus someone whose hasn't? And I guess it comes down to genetics and it comes down to history and all these things. But I guess, how do you talk about that with patients?
Generally, I start there. You're right that there's kind of a biosocial model and that there's something that was conveyed to the person biologically that probably contributed to a susceptibility or a vulnerability. And then that has been coupled with something in their learning history or environment and experiences that has sort of caused that vulnerability to be expressed, so to speak. And that there's a transactional relationship that occurs and that in certain individuals, anxiety will go on to sort of develop a life of its own and inadvertently be self-perpetuating. That's, I think, basically where I start. And then to distinguish, okay, what's sort of pathological or representative of a mental health challenge and what is normative or typical or fleeting, most mental health care providers would look for evidence in two domains, and that would be distress and impairment, so that it would be the degree of unhappiness or the degree of fear or the degree of anxiety, and is the life that they would otherwise be living or the life that they want to be living being interfered with in a way that is unwelcome, but also difficult functionally. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So if you think about maybe someone who's listening to this and thinking, okay, that makes sense to me, but what is the process, right, of this? So it sounds like you talked about collecting data mm-hmm. to kind of just learn in kind of a very complete way what the anxiety is, where it originated, what purpose does it serve, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's the first step, you know, in terms of when you meet with somebody. But then where do you go from there?
Well, I think the most important thing, or at least the first most important thing, is for potential patients or clients to be very thoughtful about the treatment providers that they're going to employ, and that they talk to their primary care providers, or that they talk to friends and family members, and that they do a bit of research on the web to make sure that the person that they're going to treat an anxiety-related condition, or to at first assess an anxiety-related condition, is well-trained and is an expert in the area, ideally. And that's very difficult, and it can be sort of taxing to find and identify a talented treatment provider. But I would say that's the most important thing. And there are a few professional websites that I think are very useful for people looking for CBT experts to provide treatment for anxiety disorders. One is abct.org, Association of Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. And another good one is Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA.org. And those both have find a therapist tools.
Perfect. Okay. I'll make sure those are included.
Perfect. Those are the places where at least the first two places that I would want people to check. Okay. And then the process is one of the scientific method, like I already sort of alluded to, where you're meeting with someone, and fit is very important. Expertise is also very important. And then together you form a collaborative team to assess, and be able to get a very good understanding of the person's sort of biological, cognitive, and behavioral contributions that seem to be at play in their mood and in their anxiety-related problems. And then together, after you're assessing, which could take anywhere, say, between 3 and 6 weeks, you're beginning then to build a conceptual model of the person's anxiety, and you're looking at the physiological contributions, the cognitive contributions, and then the behavioral contributions. And then you're beginning to tease apart what are things that are being done that are helpful and adaptive, and what are the things that are being done that might inadvertently be getting in the way of recovery.
Okay.
And typically when I'm working, I would start on the physiological portion of the model and helping someone understand what their body's doing when it gets very anxious, and what are they doing to themselves physiologically that might impact the expression of anxiety. And I usually think about 6 primary domains, which would include sleeping, their diet, what are they drinking in terms of water consumption, medications and substances, breathing practices. I would work meditation into that as well.
Okay.
And we're thinking about, okay, we have these 6 domains, and now let's assess, are there areas for improvement there that might very likely translate into some benefits in terms of their physical discomfort from anxiousness?
Got it. Okay. Huh. So it's really, you kind of start from the ground up, kind of ground up in terms of kind of just simple, very simple things that could be contributing, right?
You're trying to make it simple. At first, it's very rarely that it's in fact simple, but that's the role of the clinician, is to help a person describe what is actually happening, getting into the weeds a little bit, trying to parse apart helpful behaviors from unhelpful behaviors, helpful thinking patterns from unhelpful thinking patterns, and then all of the physiological tumult that results and how that's being managed or exacerbated. And then you need to pick a spot to focus. And for most people, if they are sort of physiologically out of whack, they're not sleeping, or they're not sleeping well, or they're not eating well, or they're using substances in a way that's counterproductive, well, then all of the cognitive and behavioral work will be built on a house of cards. And so you kind of want to make sure that someone is reasonably sturdy physiologically before you start targeting their thoughts and targeting their behaviors. And certainly, Dr. McNair, you can't sort of do any one of these things in isolation. So you're always, you know, kind of modifying or restructuring certain thinking patterns that are unhelpful from the very get-go. And you're always, mm-hmm. you know, the minute you suggest to someone to go to bed a little bit earlier, wake up a little bit earlier, or drink more water, well, those are clearly behavioral changes that directly impact physiology.
Right. How much of these first steps and kind of making it simple, kind of making it more evident for the patient that these are very specific behavioral shifts that need to happen to kind mm-hmm. of build a better foundation. Once you focus on that and you really kind of get into it and the person is making those changes, and I know everybody is different, but I mean, is that most of the progress that they make just with those steps initially? I mean, or...
Is it most of the progress over the whole goal?
Yeah.
I don't know. It sort of depends. I don't think I would say that it generally is. But if you can get someone to be behaviorally sound in terms of what we would refer to as health behaviors, it usually makes a big impact. And if you can have someone be more well-nourished, more well slept, or exercising more, almost regardless of what was getting in the way to begin with, you're going to see a significant improvement likely in mood and dip in anxiety. But without sort of targeting avoidance behaviors and without targeting certain cognitive patterns or sort of people that overestimate threat or risk, everything will sort of probably go back to where it was before. And we get significant changes there. For instance, someone going to bed earlier or discontinuing late night gaming or exercising a little bit more. If we get significant change there, there's a very high likelihood that someone's depression will improve and someone's anxiety will improve. But it's unlikely without paying specific attention to patterns of thinking and patterns of behaving. To me, it's quite unlikely that if treatment were to cease, that a person would not go back to baseline. I think that they probably would, because the thoughts and the behaviors, behavioral patterns, and especially avoidance patterns, by that time will have been pretty firmly entrenched, and it'd be shocking to me to not revert back to pre-treatment levels of either problems or kind of dysfunctional behaviors.
So I want to ask kind of what the next step is, but I wonder if it would be helpful for the listener to think about it if we use a case or a typical reason why someone might gravitate towards cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. I think it would be helpful maybe to focus specifically on a generalized anxiety, someone who says, I'm just worried all the time. And mm-hmm. maybe I'm thinking about during these times, people say, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to get sick. I'm always worried about it. It's really impacting just, you know, my quality of life and my enjoyment of just my daily routine. Mm-hmm. So how would you kind of from the beginning think about that case and work with that sort of issue?
Perfect. Okay, so let's say someone presented like that with a kind of more or less prototypical generalized anxiety disorder in the context of a health threat. And I think the atmosphere today is a perfect setup to discuss a case like this. So that person, you would want to always lead with validation. Again, emphasizing how their anxiety-related problems make sense, that many of the behaviors and their strategies are intended to be useful and in fact sometimes are useful, even if it's only for a short period of time. And you're validating before you're suggesting to them that maybe some of the things that they're doing are unhelpful. And then you're moving on with your intake and you're thinking about all of the different times and the different places and the different ways they experience anxiety. And that is to say, what cues that anxiety, when it is cued, what they notice happening in their bodies, what are their thoughts doing before, during, and after they detect a threat, and then how are they managing it in terms of their behaviors or what their bodies are doing, okay? So in an example like this, generally someone's physical symptoms would be fatigue, tension, maybe diarrhea or GI distress of some kind, probably coupled with nausea and maybe headaches and things like that, a variety of sort of somatic things upon which the volume gets turned up when they become acutely anxious. Mm-hmm. So you would initially start thinking about, okay, are there behavioral changes that we can make to address their biological offness, so to speak? And again, I would just come back to, okay, are they exercising? How are they sleeping? What are they typically eating? Are they well hydrated? If they're prescribed medications, are they taking them as prescribed? And if they're using substances, are they in the mild or moderate use of those substances? Or is it clinically contraindicated? Okay. And then someone like that, then you would ideally have 2 or 3 weeks where you're focusing together on, let's try to get you to be more healthy if there's some low-hanging fruit there, before we transition and start thinking about thoughts. In all anxiety disorders, you're thinking about 2 primary biases or mistakes that people make with their thoughts. One is an error of overestimation, and one is an error of underestimation. And the overestimation is always that they're overestimating the probability that something is going to go wrong. And we call that the probability of the threat, right? It's a likelihood estimation. And anxiety, basically by definition, means that we're going to overdo it. Why? Well, because many, many, many years ago, if we're walking somewhere in a jungle or on the savannah, it was very smart for us to presume that a broken twig represented a tiger and was actually a squirrel, than to presume it was a squirrel and it was actually a tiger. And so we're always a little bit likely under conditions of anxiety to think the negative thing is more probable than it objectively is. The second mistake we make is one of underestimation, and we underestimate our ability to cope with a problem. So a person doesn't think, oh my gosh, I could get a cold and have to miss out on this event. They think, I'm going to get something very severe and I might not make it. Or my loved one might get something very, very severe and might not make it. Now, that is obviously an appropriate way to be thinking right now in the environment and in the presence of the coronavirus pandemic. But under ordinary circumstances, and hopefully around the corner, we will again be able to recalibrate and understand that in most circumstances, the threat that's lurking around the corner isn't too likely to occur, and it isn't too bad if it was to occur. Dr. McNary, does that make sense?
Yes. So when you're kind of mapping out these errors of thinking, you could explain it to somebody, but in kind of a real life therapy process, mm-hmm. how do you work with that with somebody?
Yep. You would start looking at sort of tracking or logging their thoughts using self-monitoring between sessions, you know, for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. When anxiety jumps up, what caused it to jump up? And when it did, what were you thinking? What was the threat you were perceiving? And how likely did you perceive it to be? And how bad did you perceive it to be if it was to happen? And you would just have them log as many thoughts or as many dangers or as many threats as they perceived in a given week, ideally between 2 and say 5 a day, if that's happening. And then you're looking with them to then break it down over time. But again, you're leading with assessment, and then you're suggesting, okay, let's use some strategies here. For instance, like a pie chart. And if we were going to put the anxious thought or the scary prediction in one slice of a pie chart, what are some alternatives? And you can have a person get pretty good at rating what the sort of probability of the danger seemed like in the moment versus what does it now seem like sitting with me in a therapy room after spending 10 or 15 minutes considering other possible outcomes. And little by little by little, with practice, a person gets more swift at implementing some sort of probability estimations in their day-to-day life in real time. But it takes practice, it takes patience, it takes collaboration with a therapist, but it's definitely something that can be learned, and it doesn't take that long to be able to say to oneself, whoa, 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 I can tell I'm getting carried away. This is a scary prospect, but let me think about some of the alternatives that are probably more likely to occur. And then we can find it a little bit more easy to take risks once we've sort of identified that the risk is pretty small.
Got it.
It sounds a lot easier than it is, but it is also not too difficult.
Yeah, just kind of redefining the framework of how someone kind of assigns the hierarchy of importance of something, right? Mm-hmm. And likelihood. So it's kind of shifting around, kind of putting it out there in a way that in a more kind of rational kind of way of thinking about it that is, I mean, in itself, very therapeutic.
It can be. It can be. And oftentimes you'll suggest to someone, you know, it can be very swift. You can say, well, how many times have you been convinced that you're going to get very ill? And that number is probably in the hundreds, if not thousands. And they oftentimes can't recall ever being very, very ill. And there's a subset of people maybe that actually did have a learning history where they were very sick or a loved one was very, very sick, either in the distant or recent past. But in most cases, they've been convinced they're going to get very ill 1,000 times and it's yet to happen. And that outside the context of a lot of physiological anxiety can be very convincing. And then the trick is how do we harness that clarity and allow it to be brought forth even in the throes of an anxious spike.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And that's kind of really how the therapist, I think it like massages it and it kind of changes the way someone thinks about their anxiety and approaches it and processes it, right?
That's exactly what happens. And then the second piece, which I can be more brief with, is helping someone come to terms with what they would actually do if the thing that they're afraid of were to take place. So in the case of someone with generalized anxiety that has something to do with a health concern or a financial concern, you would walk them through almost in a narrative-like fashion. Let's hypothetically say this occurred, right? That you had to declare bankruptcy or that you were diagnosed with a certain condition. What would you do? What would you do in the first hour after finding out? What would you do in the subsequent 24 hours? And what would you do in the subsequent 3 months to be able to manage that situation? Because like it or not, people do in fact have these things happen to them and they make it and they resume a meaningful and important and cherished life. And if you help someone really think it through and come up almost with a coping plan for the disaster that they fear, well, it's a little less scary to think that something very, very scary, very, very harmful, very threatening could occur, and it wouldn't be the end of us in most circumstances.
Right.
That can also be very therapeutic. So then following the sort of recalibration, if you will, or sort of adjustment or bringing thinking patterns or sort of our biases when we're anxious, once we've addressed those or we're thoroughly in the process of addressing those, you want to help someone understand what their anxiety-driven behaviors are. And in general, people that are anxious want to get away or want to avoid or want to use what we call safety behaviors. And safety behaviors are kind of micro avoidances. So if you're willing to go and give the speech, but you might only do so with your notes in your pocket, or you're willing to go to the hospital, but you're only willing to do it with maybe a safety cue, like a certain person, or wearing kind of a good luck outfit, or having exhaustively researched that medical center to see if it poses certain risk to you. Those would be like safety behaviors. And in many cases, a person's avoidances or use of safety behaviors is kind of outside of their awareness, or it's outside of their awareness how the avoidance is accidentally keeping their anxiety in place by getting in the way of them learning, oh, wait, I can confront this threat, I can confront this challenge, and I'll still be okay. If the challenge or the threat is never confronted, well, of course, that allows the thought that I'm not up to this to remain in place. And that's why effective CBT always helps a person learn what they're avoiding and to gradually, over time, decrease that avoidance so that A, they're getting a chance to learn that they're up for it and that the threat probably doesn't occur, but they're also getting an increasing sense of their own capability, courage, and bravery and what their true capacity is, not what they thought it was, but what it actually is. And that's one of the primary sources of empowerment when a person is participating in CBT.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you could give kind of just a few sentences about CBT versus kind of more traditional therapy modalities, you know, what the difference is. Is it just CBT? I mean, I think of CBT as more directive mm-hmm. and more action-oriented. What are some things that you kind of just describe as the difference between CBT and other modalities of therapy?
I think that's a big one to me. Well, let me say this will vary between provider. Okay, so that a non-CBT therapy delivered by anyone will vary between provider. And in exactly the same way, CBT delivered between providers will vary a fair amount. So any provider could answer this differently. But to me, sort of holistically, I think CBT distinguishes itself because of its emphasis on science and the scientific method. It also distinguishes itself because it is, like you're saying, solution-focused and somewhat directive, okay? But there is a massive emphasis in CBT about collaborative empiricism. And that is to say that the client and the therapist form a sort of scientific team, and they're looking to understand and then change. And because of that, it is partially directive, but the team is directive, suggesting to the client what would be helpful based on past experience or based on experiments that you're doing in therapy or what you've witnessed together. It's very unusual for the therapist to simply tell a client what to do. It's usually that they come to that understanding together as they've interpreted some of the evidence they've gathered week over week. I think the emphasis on assessment and a functional understanding, and rather than presupposing that a certain thing is helpful or unhelpful, there is in CBT a value that you can't do anything until you've determined that you have a very solid understanding of all of the variables that are at play in a person's life. And so that allows CBT to be very thoughtful and very deliberate. And I like that as well. And I think it's a distinguishing factor.
Okay. Anybody that you could think of that you would say, you know, maybe cognitive behavioral therapy isn't right for you?
I don't think so. I have yet to see that. I do a lot of supervising, and many of my trainees are trained in forms of therapy that are not CBT. And it's hard for me as a CBT therapist, in the way that I was trained, to not think of nearly every aspect of human psychological life as not involving cognition, behavior, or physiology. And if you can explain a phenomenon to me that isn't a thought, it's not a behavior, and it's not a sensation or a feeling, I don't know what it is. One could make an argument maybe regarding spirituality, but that to me too is generally in the form of thinking. And so to me, I can't think of anyone that wouldn't be appropriate to participate in CBT. To me, it would be more a matter of, are they interested in it? Do they buy into it? Does a given client or patient like the stance of CBT? And do they have an excellent fit with their specific provider? Or are they very, very interested in another therapeutic technique? And the evidence suggests that a person's sort of preferences heading into treatment are going to have an effect on outcome. So if someone is very skeptical of CBT or outright doesn't want to participate in CBT, then I think it's probably wise for them not to, because the evidence suggests they're less likely to be improved.
Got it. Okay. So this is a question I often ask people that I interview, because I think it helps shed light on the modality of therapy itself. Mm-hmm. What about this therapy are you drawn to? And why is it such an important part of your practice in treating clients?
For me, I like it because it is so effective. So I'm an anxiety specialist. I primarily treat anxiety-related disorders. And I started doing research between undergraduate and graduate school, and my eyes were widened when I saw how effective the treatment for anxiety using CBT can be. And for me, that's the name of the game. And I like the fact that it is a skillful and effective blend of science and art that allows therapy to be very, very effective for mood and anxiety disorders. And that's what I love. I think there's a bit of a, in some circles, a prejudice against CBT for being less warm or for being less intimate or less emotional. And I don't find that to be the case. And I find science to be sort of one of our leading values in CBT. But CBT affords for the inclusion of such meaningful change and connection and artful delivery that really makes it very reinforcing, extremely fun. And sometimes I'm asked, isn't it difficult to be a psychologist treating fear and anxiety disorders all the time? It seems like it would be kind of a downer. And every single time I insist, it's exactly the opposite, because within 2 or 3 weeks, most people, in fact, almost everyone, begins opening doors in their life that they've had closed for a very, very long time. And before you know it, sometimes it's very, very bright. It's very optimistic. It's hopeful. And it doesn't take much more than a few weeks to turn that corner. That's what I like more than anything, is the ability to really, really treat someone into no longer having a mental health problem, and that those changes are evidenced pretty darn quickly.
Right. All the information is very helpful. And I think a listener who might be interested in this type of therapy, I think it's really helpful to hear what you have to say about it and how you think about the treatment course. And also in terms of your feeling and the evidence backing the effectiveness of this type of treatment. So what I will do, I will make sure that I have those two websites that you suggested earlier on, the ABCT and the ADAA.org, in order for people who might be considering thinking about cognitive behavioral therapy to maybe just to search a provider in that way. And I'll also include your website so people can learn a little bit more about you as well.
That sounds perfect. Thank you so much.
This has been Mind Stories. With remote appointments in California and offices in downtown Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Hermosa Beach, Marina Del Rey, and Echo Park, Cal Psychiatry specializes in medication management, mood and anxiety disorders, alternative therapies, women's mental health, and more to help you get back to your true self. Visit us at calpsychiatry.com. Thank you for listening to Mind Stories, and don't forget to subscribe.